This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Matthew Pagan. We're going to be discussing some of the social impacts of the COVID pandemic and also some of our upcoming projects. Matt, it's great having you back on.
Hey, Robert. Good to be back on. It's been some time. I mean, you and I are friends, obviously, so we talk very often, but I don't think I've been on the show for maybe 6 months or so.
Do you want to kind of explain why you decided to go under your real name?
Yeah, well, I mean, before I went under Matt Pagas, but it was, one could always find my name if they looked. I was never really truly anonymous. Yeah, I mean, I started doing your show about 2 years ago. At the time, it seemed advisable to maintain some degree of anonymity because I didn't necessarily know. I didn't even know you that well at the time. I didn't necessarily know what I was getting myself involved in. But at this point, you know, 2 years later, we got the coronavirus pandemic going on. It's not even clear that there is such a thing called the alt-right anymore. It seems a lot easier just to do shows like this with people that I like you talking about issues that I care about without really having to be worried that I'm going to be lumped in with some set of views that I don't agree with.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, like with, waves of deplatforming, like some kind of big event would happen. And I'm on the record, like, I'm not associated or identifying with a lot of that stuff, but that's just how things sometimes go, like how controversies go. And there was this kind of thing where if you had any kind of views, even if you didn't explicitly identify as alt-right, there was a lot of tension and controversy about that. And there were different factors. I think the election of Trump was that, like the media, the woke media, and tech companies got very militant against Trump. And now that Trump is more kind of associated with mainstream conservatism and dissidents are less associated with Trump, that's less of an issue. Also, like, there was this idea of the alt-right as being like this queer identity. And now it's more kind of just people openly exchanging ideas about politics and culture online.
And you see a lot of cross-pollination between the Red Scare podcast folks and people that are sort of somewhat dissident right-leaning, and there's this whole kind of weird right emerging with podcasts like the Perfume Nationalist.
And we're going to, I plan on having him on the show, but he was on the Twink Revolution, and Twink Revolution, they're like the dissident left or anti-woke left. They're kind of, they're sort of allied with like people like Michael Tracy and Amy Therese.
Yeah, and you see these, what once would have been called, and I hate to use this term even, but once would have been called sort of quote-unquote red-pilled ideas about culture and politics. You see that they've kind of trickled down from a place where they were just strictly associated with what would be considered toxic corners of the internet, and they're now kind of getting reevaluated by creative types and even some on the left as well. And you see that with this new, that Feel When No GF movie, where you had Ariel Pink, who's one of my favorite pop musicians, co-producing that. So you see some of these ideas kind of being reevaluated by both people who are not politically of the right, but also people who are creative and artistic types. And it just feels like a fruitful moment to just kind of be your, not to sound corny, but to just kind of be yourself online. And there's not, the witch hunts have died down. It's long story short, everything has gotten kind of dissipated and fragmented to where I think there is a real opportunity now for people to just be kind of creatively associate with what they choose to associate with without worrying too much about the guilt by association.
Yeah, at this point, like, a lot of people, they're taking a break from politics and just focusing on culture. And yeah, with that doc I saw too, TFW, no GF, I don't think that doc could have been made and get, like, mainstream respectability 2 years ago. I am noticing a change, and I listened to an interview with Alex Lee Moyer, who directed that, and she was saying, within Hollywood, there was, like, some pressure not to portray things a certain way. But the thing is, like, what were they saying, like, there were different people in Hollywood saying, like, you should, like, to be cautious about portraying these individuals who are alienating themselves in a too positive light. But the thing is, like, that didn't prevent her. She was still able to make the film, and it's definitely, it's a piece of art, the cinematography, the music, the graphics, and overall themes. There's no, like, political narrative. It's more just, like, telling the story and getting a feel of what it's like to know these people. But yeah, it's on Amazon, so I recommend watching it.
Yeah, absolutely, if you haven't already. And as far, it's not a political documentary, I agree with that. In as far as it is a political documentary, it's not clearly of the right. It's more of this kind of, what we would have called, you know, 2 years ago, a kind of dissident or alt-center. I'm not going to label it that. I'm kind of done with all those labels. But suffice it to say that in as far as it does have a political agenda, it's not clearly of the left or of the right. It's kind of just portraying a certain degree of suffering, which you could point to both economic factors and social factors to explain that suffering of incels and neets and such.
I guess the one, like, political angle is in the... Most of it is just totally no political narrative. But in the very beginning, she does mention, like, income inequality, social dysfunction, especially impacting millennial men. There was this other doc called The Red Pill, and that was more kind of like middle-aged MRAs. And I noticed, like, with that scene, yeah, like, there was a scene called The Manosphere, or the MRA, or Men's Rights MRA, that was really big 5 to 10 years ago. But with a lot of those types, like, the problem is they took themselves, like, way too seriously, and they put themselves in a position where they were sort of easier to be ridiculed by the establishment. But I noticed with this new subculture that's portrayed in TFW, no GF, they have a much stronger, they're much edgier. I don't want to use that word edgy, but they have an avant-garde edge, or a counterculture edge that those past scenes really failed to do.
Oh, yeah, it has better aesthetics. It's more a lot of it, and this is not to say, there's a lot of very good, rational, clear-headed arguments that come out of this scene, but it's a lot of it is based on feelings. I mean, it's that feel with no GF. So a lot of it is a channeling of a certain emotion and suffering put into art, whereas the boomer MRA stuff, it's like you agree with it or you don't. And it's a little, I mean, I some of that stuff, some of those points are good. The old boomer MRA points, but they're also a little cringe in their presentation. And yeah, I mean, the intention today wasn't to do a podcast on the movie, but I mean, it's worth talking about a little. The intention wasn't to do a podcast on that face with no GF, but it's worth talking about. I mean, I think what makes it so much better than the Red Pill documentary for me is that the Red Pill is all about these boomer MRA talking points, whereas this is about something much more vital and of the moment. And I really think, maybe I'm naive here, but I really think a documentary like that and just other, if people can produce other cultural products like that, I think it will break through to a certain faction of the left, a certain faction of quote-unquote normies, and it will change the conversation.
Yeah, so what we're going to be focusing is on the COVID pandemic, but the impact it has on social trends, including trends like that are portrayed in the movie, because it does seem like kind of analyzing mental health and reading stuff online, talking to people I know about what they're saying about people they know, their friends and acquaintances, and that a lot of people who seem to be, who basically have their shit together, a lot of those people are actually having like total mental breakdowns, while a lot of people who seem maybe to have been more, had more problems in the past, they seem to be more at peace.
The question is, a lot of people existentially identify very strongly with their jobs and their work, and these tend to be, you know, more unless you're really lucky and you have a great job, these tend to be more normie type of people who, without being able to work the job that they work, they don't know who they are. They don't know what to do with themselves. They say they spend all day watching TV, what have you. And then you have people who are a little more creative, or just haven't been able to fit into mainstream society as well in general. And this isn't just people who listen to your show. I'm sure it also goes for, you know, a lot of SJW types as well, just people who don't fit in as well with mainstream society. And you give them a chance to kind of do their own thing, and they're much more used to knowing how to spend, you know, how to do productive things with free time and all that. And these are people like you and I that we have our own projects that we like to focus on that we don't necessarily earn money on. So when we're out of work temporarily, it actually gives us a chance to catch up on all these things that we've been wanting to do. And it's actually very liberating and fun, you know. That combined with the fact that I've probably been getting more sleep than I have in, like, possibly since the middle of high school, and that I've been getting probably better exercise than I have since college, and I'm doing quite well, I would say.
It depends your situation. So if you want to comment on your personal situation, like being able to work from home, having like more free time to work on creative projects, it'd be interesting to see how much like cultural productivity goes up, like creating podcasts, writing books, yep. Visual art, all kinds of intellectual endeavors. I mean, if there is going to be a lot of success, maybe like a mini cultural renaissance, that really does vindicate like the argument that you do need some kind of a leisure. You need more leisure for creative endeavors as opposed to the culture where everyone always has to be working and competing to make ends meet.
Yeah, for an economic bottom line. I mean, I would love to see this hashtag or this meme go off of the Corona Renaissance. I don't know if it's manifesting in reality yet, but it's definitely manifesting for me in my personal work. Now, that's all not to say it's as easy as all that too. There's a lot of pitfalls to having free time. You know, drug use is up, pornography use is up, all of these things. Like, it's not always easy. And definitely for the first like couple weeks of this thing, this quarantine, there was some, you know, trial and error with how to like arrange my day and spend my time. But I feel like in this month of April, I've kind of hit my stride. We'll talk more about our upcoming projects later on the show, maybe. But I finally finished this novel I've been working on for years. I'm going back and editing all this footage I have on my computer that I honestly never thought that I would ever turn into anything, because I just didn't think I'd have the time. Editing is very time consuming. But I found the time, and I get this great joy out of going to Premiere Pro and just editing these videos, even if they're not very good, you know, and just kind of being able to enjoy the fruits of my own labor. It's been really great. And yeah, we'll see if there's a real strong effect of that over the whole culture, whether we're going to start seeing, I mean, I feel like I've seen it a little bit on certain corners of Twitter. I don't know if it will fully manifest in the culture. But it will be interesting to see if there's a more full-fledged renaissance, so to speak.
So 2016 was a groundbreaking year, and it's kind of interesting like to look back at the nostalgia and to watch all those old Chatelet videos, remember how enthusiastic people were, and then into the Trump presidency. And it's not so much just, I don't want to make it about Trump, it's just sort of about the era, the zeitgeist in general, but there seemed to be this era of just like complete like stagnation for 2 years. I think there wasn't any major tragedy like there is now, but at the same time, there was nothing really, like no groundbreaking events in a positive way either. It was just like, that's how I felt like the Trump presidency, like as I'm saying, may not be entirely about Trump, but just sort of like the past few years, it just felt like everything's been totally stagnant, like politics, culture.
Yeah, honestly, pretty much for as long as I've been like listening to your show, ironically, it's just been this slow stagnation of people getting more and more disappointed by Trump. Or I mean, and again, maybe it's not all about Trump. It's probably not all the man's fault, but just people getting slowly, you know, disillusioned that he really would represent any significant change to the status quo. I mean, obviously he has represented a change to the status quo, but has that change really grown since 2016? Not really. Like, nothing significant has happened since he got elected. It was more of a symbolic thing for a lot of people, and it's just been this kind of slow stagnation. But now, and this has been a long time coming, but I think with coronavirus and with this unbelievable fact that we're actually having a presidential election later this year that no one's thinking about really, well, obviously people are, but we're also preoccupied with coronavirus. Now it seems like there's never been a better time to like just not care about politics and instead just focus on, you know, your own, if you're a creative person, just focus on your own stuff and kind of inflect that with whatever kind of dissident views you've imbibed, but not, it's just definitely not about electoral politics anymore.
Yeah, I have upcoming projects as well. I'm working on a book and get to these upcoming projects later on, but just to go back to what we were saying about the current situation with the coronavirus, it's interesting to watch kind of some of the divides about Trump's response and how different people are reacting politically. So we were talking about in the beginning of the show how the stigma about like dissident right politics or dissident politics has, it's not as bad. So I think another reason is that, so you have people like Richard Spencer, and he was viciously deplatformed in the past. He seems to be doing better now, but it's interesting about the narrative about the coronavirus is he's actually allied with much of the mainstream left on this, that we do have to take this seriously, and if it means supporting like strong lockdowns and quarantines. The energy of the left is mainly in opposition to Trump and also to the conservatives, who are basically taking the line that it's going to, that the quarantine will, because it would wreck the economy. And some of them, in the very early stages, a lot of conservatives were diminishing the threat. Like, it's like that meme, it's just the flu, bro. Yeah, I mean, right now, that's the main, like, political divide over the narrative. And also, yeah, like, with political dissidents, there's obviously going to be division over that as well.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's this is new lines are being drawn, and people, you see people kind of changing their minds and going back and forth. I mean, I think new lines are being drawn in the sand in a way that we haven't seen since 2016. And I've honestly checked out of most of it, to be honest. I definitely am in the camp of, you know, take this thing as seriously as possible, that is coronavirus, but also, you know, I don't really let it inflect my general views on it. It hasn't necessarily changed my views of Trump that much. I just think there's so much confusion and so many people believing so many different things and getting their information from so many different places that at this point I'm not emotionally invested in any of the debates. I mean, I'm definitely not a flu bro. I take the coronavirus seriously. I wear the mask and what have you, and I do my best to keep myself and those around me safe from it, but I'm just so not invested in any of the political debates surrounding it. And I think a lot of the concerns are valid on all sides, not to sound like a total pushover about the issue, but like, of course we should be worrying about the virus while at the same time worrying about the economy and all of these things. And I'm paying attention, but in a really detached way.
Yeah, because if you look at what political positions are vindicated, it seems to be on one hand more nationalism, like stronger borders, nationalism in the sense that we have to kind of work together within like the tribe or within the nation, as opposed to, because crises force nations to take maybe a more nationalistic approach. But on the other hand, it does vindicate a more left-wing economic policies of investing more in healthcare, paid sick leave, need for basic income. And
yeah,
those are the positions that are vindicated, but the way the political spectrum is set up, they rarely overlap in any major political figures, but those basically are kind of the practical things to do. What should ideally be done is a complete shutdown on immigration, but then maybe possibly extending that like until the economy recovers. I think it's rational to have a complete moratorium on immigration. And then, obviously, a basic income of, I mean, I would say, like, everyone gets, like, $2,000 a month as long as, yeah, the quarantine is in place. And what Trump has done is he's done that sort of, like, one-time rebate, the one-time cash payout for everyone, but a massive bailout of big corporations. And his immigration, like, at first it seems like he was going to do an immigration ban, but that's even that has, like, made exceptions for, like, all kinds of visa workers. So that was pretty much watered down. So even, and as far as immigration goes, I don't think, if the economy is in shambles, like, we're going to see a dramatic reduction anyhow, so that doesn't really matter. But from the symbolic standpoint, a lot of Trump's handling of this is probably, like, similar to what would have happened if Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney were elected.
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, he's hit some good notes, but as with so many other things in the Trump presidency, I mean, he's hit the notes without necessarily following through in the way that we'd like.
And also, if there's these red states like Tennessee and Georgia, they're reopening their economy, and if there's a major spike in cases, that will really harm Republicans in the upcoming election.
Yeah, and I want to talk about electoral politics in a moment, but first on the metapolitical level, I had some real hope, and I think some of this hope is still alive, but I think we've seen things gotten more partisan over the past few weeks in a way that is disheartening. I had some hope that that something like this pandemic would make people more inward-looking, kind of more sober in their thinking, and in being sober in their thinking, move towards something that we've always advocated, which is something that's more egalitarian on economics, but at the same time more socially conservative and just more nationalistic. I kind of had a hope that people would kind of come together on some of these issues of, like, of reorganizing this, you know, society to focus less on the individual and more on, you know, the family unit and focus on, you know, getting people decent work and a decent living and you know, incentivizing, you know, people who look out for one another and work together in a tribal sense or as a family unit. Just, I had a real hope that there'd be a more sober center that would arise in American politics following this, and maybe it will. But over the past few weeks, we've seen things devolve into partisan politics, as they always do, with these people, you know, the red state protests, against the lockdown and, you know, the horrible backlash. I don't agree with the anti-lockdown protests, but the backlash against them has been, I mean, you know, explicitly, it's just been very hateful, honestly, with things trending like how to spot a redneck. And then on the other side, basically what I'm trying to say is that things have gotten more partisan over the past few weeks, which kind of lessens my hope that a more common sense center will emerge out of this. But to touch on electoral politics, I think there's a lot of interesting questions about, and at this point, I just don't know. I mean, for a while, I thought maybe Trump, if he handles this properly and is able to end the lockdown at, like, just the right time and get the economy back while also, you know, not making the virus spike too much, I thought maybe this, you know, Trump could come out ahead of the pandemic. But at this point, I just think we have absolutely no way of knowing, like, how this virus is going to affect the results in November. I think it's impossible to know at this point, because it's not like Biden is doing an especially great job of, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, because Trump, it's going to be interesting to see the election, because on one hand, like, if Trump will be vulnerable if the economy is in shambles and the number of people who died from coronavirus massively increases. But then you kind of see, like, Biden's, his mental state has, like, deteriorated, and he hasn't really had to do a really intense full-on debate like he will have to. So if Biden performs poor, it's really hard to say. And who knows the election? There's talk of elections being delayed and the legal authority behind that, and whether if there is an election, will some people will stay home, and then the left will talk about the voter suppression. So there's a lot of different angles to that.
It's going to be a mess. The only thing I feel comfortable predicting is that it's going to be, I think, one of the lowest turnouts maybe in history, or if not, yeah, at least recent history, right? The lowest turnout, both because of coronavirus fears and also because, and I could be wrong on this, maybe people really do love Joe Biden and maybe people are less disaffected with Trump than I think.
Biden's policies are indistinguishable from Hillary's, but I mean, I'm personally not a fan of Biden, but compared to Hillary, he's obviously much more likable.
He is more likable, even just on a personal have a beer with this guy level. So he's going to do better in some of those Midwestern states that he needs to win. But how much better, I don't know. Basically, the way I see this election in November, it's going to be the war of two competing status quos, if that even makes sense. Can you have more than one status quo? I think in a way you can, because you have Joe Biden who says the status quo can be returned the way it was in like 2016, and we just need to move past Trump. And you have Trump, who obviously is the status quo in a more true sense. And it's those things going head to head. I don't know. And anything could happen. You know, I think that Trump is a stronger candidate than Biden. I think he'll do better in the debates. He'll sling a lot of shit at him.
Bernie was really pathetic in the last debate with Biden.
Bernie was, yeah. I'd only watched some of it. But I think that Trump will be a stronger candidate. But I don't, just with demographics and, you know, all the Trump voters who passed away since 2016.
You're talking about from coronavirus or just in general?
Just in general. I mean, it's the age. I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but the age difference between Trump voters and Hillary voters was quite stark. I thought where older voters leaned pretty heavily towards Trump in those swing states. And who knows? My main point is I think Trump's a stronger candidate. He'll definitely make Biden work really hard, but I think that Biden could just pull ahead if because the excitement that was there for Trump in 2016 is not going to be
there. The excitement that was key because every candidate who is successful, there is excitement around them. So the last election there was excitement around Trump, but not around Hillary. Obama obviously inspired excitement from his base, and right now, just look, comparing the memes, like the original memes that we had of Trump in 2016 compared to like the current memes that you see with a lot of like boomer Trump supporters.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's obviously Biden is not an exciting candidate, but is Trump really any more exciting? I don't know at this point.
He just threw away like a really amazing opportunity. If he combined like those positions, like the UBI, giving everyone $2,000 a month, and even Trudeau was like this woke neoliberal, but even he's doing a lot of the things right as far as what I'm talking about, combined with a much more serious like an immigration moratorium, and not so much about the numbers of people coming in, it just sends like a strong message of what he stands for. Like that really could create a new political alliance, and a lot of it could appeal to a lot of disaffected Bernie Sanders supporters. But if you think like the last election, there was this kind of like Bernie to Trump or the Obama Trump voters. I have been reading that Trump has actually done slightly better with non-white voters.
Yeah.
But he's doing worse with white voters in crucial swing states. So I think those voters he's losing, he is popular with Republicans, but he doesn't have the same crossover appeal which he did in 2016. And that is kind of like, that is crucial to a lot of like what we're talking about, like whether we can have like a new dissident center. And there was some of that with the last election, but this election, like the divide, we're kind of back to where we were before, where it was like woke liberalism versus just basic conservatism.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point that Trump could win on that alone. I mean, for as many voters as he's lost, he's replaced a lot of them with, he's more popular with people of color. But perhaps more important than that, he's vastly more popular with the Republican base. And it's easy to forget how much of the Republican base that he did. Now, I think a lot of those people did end up voting for him in 2016, so I'm not sure. But, I mean, I think he's, for example, I'm originally from near Philadelphia, and Chester County, which is just west of Delaware County where I'm from, is a classic like rich Republican county, and they were strong for Romney in 2012, and they actually flipped to Hillary in 2016.
Yeah, it was the same with Orange County in Southern California, near where we are. You saw like a wealthy county which went from Romney to Clinton, and there were the kind of the Obama to Trump counties were primarily like working class white communities in the upper Midwest.
Yeah. It's really, I think it's just really hard to know how that's going to play out in this term, because I don't think Orange County's ever going to go red again, but I could imagine some suburban counties in the Midwest going for Trump, but then at the same time, Biden seems to do really well with suburban women, so maybe I'm completely wrong about that. To bring us full circle to how we started talking about electoral politics, I think it's just really impossible to know right now, you know, where people's minds are at with this coronavirus pandemic and how that's going to affect their vote. And it seems like the only safe prediction to make is that turnout's not going to be high.
That's the situation with electoral politics. It's interesting to see what impact the pandemic will have on just overall social interaction, whether it will increase social bonds or could very well have the opposite, lead to more like social atomization.
Yeah, I mean, I think it underscores the need to have strong social bonds in a big way, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to be the effect. I think we're seeing competing trends right now, or maybe not even competing trends, but there's an opportunity, there's a real opportunity for that underscore of family and social bonds to be made, which is an inherently socially conservative tendency that could be, you know, increased in the United States and in the world. But we're also seeing, you know, pornography use skyrocketing, drug use skyrocketing, OnlyFans skyrocketing, and will it have a positive or negative effect?
I do think it does benefit people who already have families, so there are people spending more time with their kids, and maybe, like, possibly it's almost like a return to homeschooling since the schools are shut down and both parents and kids are home. And that's something you can make, like, a social conservative case for. But I also think people are going to be interacting less. So people are just, in general, they're suspicious of crowds. And, like, the whole concept of cocooning, it's something that this whole series that the blogger Agnostic talks about, and he gives examples. He gets really into detail about different social trends. He even talks about, well, one thing he talked about, which is kind of silly, is about like urinal partitions as a new thing because people value like their personal space more. And that's actually, then I saw something, some meme or just some image of like, because of coronavirus, they're removing the middle urinal so people can social distance. So social distancing, like literally, I mean, it is kind of a social disconnect. So I do think it is possible there could be more social atomization.
Yeah, it's like if you have a family or some kind of group to go to, you're in good hands. But if you don't, you know, it's going to get worse. That's kind of how it is. And that's unfortunate because obviously we are so atomized that, yeah, I think we have to be a bit pessimistic about this, unfortunately.
Yeah. So like you'll have like a lot of, like incels and neets will joke about how like normies are being forced into their position.
Yeah. No, that's one of the most fascinating things about this is how we're all kind of neets now and even incels. I was kind of joking the other day about how, you know, chads and women who, you know, who hook up a lot, who that's, you know, that's their main sexual outlet. They're all effectively incels. Whereas now, you know, people who are actually in stable long-term relationships can just quarantine with their partners. And like now we're at the top of the hierarchy. So it has interesting effects like that. It takes away certain outlets that some people had, and it kind of awards people who have stronger ties in the first place.
Another trend will be interesting will be to see the impact of an economic collapse, an economic breakdown. So that part is hard to say because there's one angle that's touched upon in documentary is that the whole sort of like a lot of that alienation and the incel epidemic is a product of an economic despair. But then I've also heard the argument that a lot of social problems that incels and just kind of traditionalist and dissident right types, the social breakdowns that they complain about, are kind of the theme in a lot of like Welbeck's novels about how like social and romantic relations resemble capitalism. A lot of those social dysfunctions are a product of economic prosperity. So you could actually make both cases, because in a economic collapse, people are forced to rely upon each other for basic needs, like the kind of you can't really afford to be like a radical individualist.
Yeah, no, it's a real kick in the pants for me culture, or the, you know, me generation shit. And it feels like that should be good in the long term, but there's, when you're talking about something like economic collapse and a pandemic, as even though it should have good effects, there's just so many ways, even though it should have effects that would limit that sort of thing, it's at core, it's still like a bad thing that's going to negatively affect people. And so I still lean towards being pessimistic with hope for certain trends at the same time. You know, my net thoughts on a lot of what we've been talking about is that a lot of this social scrambling that's occurring because of external events, I think it's going to obviously it's going to negatively affect most people, but I think there's also a real opportunity for people who may or may not have been doing spectacularly in the previous status quo to sort of to ascend in a way. People who know better how to, you know, spend free time, people who are more self-starters, people with, you know, strong social bonds. It's a net bad for society, perhaps, but it's also, it's a pregnant moment. It's a moment in which, you know, good things can come out of it if you're lucky, if you're in the right position, if you have the willpower. One interesting thing about when the economy is doing worse and when people are more economically dependent on a family unit is that, again, it sort of it undermines me generation stuff. So maybe that will prevent people from having as much promiscuous sex and drug use and all of these bad things. And it could be good for the type of people who actually want to have more build, you know, lasting family connections and such. One thing that is interesting that you brought up is homeschooling, whether we're going to see an increase in homeschooling now. It's interesting timing because at this very moment, I guess I haven't read all these articles, but I guess there's a Harvard professor, a group of people from Harvard who are like advocating banning homeschooling. But I was actually homeschooled almost my entire life up until college.
That kind of ties back to what we were saying earlier about how both the left and the right make the disconnect between the social and the economic component. So I'm very sympathetic to the cause of homeschooling, but what conservatives don't get is you do need some kind of like outside funding. It's not like conservatives will defend homeschooling, which I'm sympathetic to, but then they'll also defend the model that everyone has to go out and make all their money working through a corporation. Like, I understand like the conservative arguments or libertarian arguments that there are problems with socialism and having the government run everything. But what I do think is, I do think people should have opportunities to have like their own independent source of income where they're not dependent on external forces, on these major institutions. So yeah. One of them, a UBI, could be part of the solution, but also changing regulations, like making it easier for people to be independent contractors, entrepreneurs, and self-employed.
I think that would be ideal. And people of a kind of boomer right-wing mentality are against UBI because they think it's payouts from the government. It is, of course, payouts from the government. But I think we're at a point in the development of late capitalism, shall we say, where it's obvious to me that it's more socially conservative to have a simple payout from the government than it is to rely on woke capital corporations for your welfare.
That's kind of the whole thing of like the populist argument against conservatism, how conservatives, they'll basically like economically empower institutions that a lot of these corporations will flat out fire you if you have like a social media account that's MAGA.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas our government in the U.S. would never do that. I mean, there's obviously problems with big government, but the government, maybe it's just a generational thing. To me, it seems like a vastly less pernicious force than corporations. I'm sure there's a lot of conspiracy theorists who would love to prove me wrong on that, about how bad the things our government does are. But still, I would rather pay out. I would rather rely on the government than corporations.
And I also think the pandemic and economic situation, I could very well see inequality get much worse, because what's happened is big corporations are bailed out. Amazon's doing very well with the whole online situation and like online self-order, but small businesses are bankrupting, and a lot of them will permanently shut down. Yeah, we are seeing the whole trend, automation that Yang talked about, that's accelerating.
Accelerating.
So in a lot of ways, income inequality could very well get much worse.
It could get much worse. I mean, my honest take on this is that in the long term, the government should probably nationalize things like Amazon. I know that sounds a bit...
nationalize Google, Amazon. Nationalize it and you generate the revenue for like a UBI, because I know there are like some of the Bernie supporters were skeptical of Yang's UBI program because Jeff Bezos came out in support of it, and I totally get that, because this definitely does transition to the book I'm writing about. I don't want to spoil the plot of my new novel, but I will touch on the theme. So one of the themes in my novel is different future scenarios. So the theme of basically kind of like channeling a lot of dissonant energy, cultural and economic, and into a kind of dystopia where there is just like a basic subsistence living, but then there's these kind of outlets like VR. I will say, like, the candidate, like Roger Blackstone, who's in my first book, he is reintroduced into the second book. His political idea of anyone being able to live in the society that they want to, and that being kind of the ideal, versus the establishment co-opting that message and saying, you will be able to live out your dreams, but it'll be fake. And that's kind of also a lot of like online, you could also make that case of online subcultures are doing that to a degree.
Yeah, no, there's pitfalls. You want to, you know, balance, you know, pushing for real social change, you know, with also kind of enjoying yourself online and the memes of it all. You know, it's got to be a balance of both, you know, subcultural comforts of actually having a place online to go with also, you know, not letting yourself get totally cucked by the forces of the external world, which actually are quite content for you to just stay online.
That's just sort of a basic teaser for my upcoming novel, and you'll obviously hear more about that as it progresses. I do want to plug some of our other projects. So Matt and I are on YouTube. We have this series. It's an LA nostalgia tour, and that's something we actually filmed this with David Cole. We filmed it 2 years ago, but Matt, since you were busy with work, you weren't able to get it up there. But the first one we filmed, it's of the West Side Pavilion Mall. And that's actually, since then, it's been demolished. We got some footage of that before they demolished it.
Yeah, basically you, David, and I toured the former West Side Pavilion back in 2018. We also went to Mr. C's Hotel in Beverly Hills, which is a cool hotel that used to be the Renaissance Hotel in the 70s. And we went to some other malls as well, and we basically just walked through these sites of architectural and cultural interest in L.A. And both you and David, you guys are both L.A. natives. I'm a transplant. And I videoed you, and you went into a lot of your nostalgia and memories of these different places.
We did a show with David Cole in L.A., a show on, like, the history of L.A. malls. And we recorded that show about 2 years ago. But that podcast was actually kind of the inspiration for an actual doc idea. So it became, instead of like not so much like just, like there are these like dead mall series, but we decided to just, instead of about being about dead malls, just like an LA nostalgia tour.
An LA nostalgia tour, and you and David get very personal in it about your own memories of growing up here. And it's interesting because Southern California, I mean, there's a lot of negative things you could say about it, but it's definitely an interesting place to be from, right? And you guys I hadn't gone over the footage really since 2018 when we filmed it. I think there's a lot of, it's understated, and my camera work was definitely lacking back then, and for a lot of it, I didn't have a good microphone. This isn't a high production value thing, but I think there's a lot of gems in there, just anecdotes that you and David tell. And yeah, it's going to be a three-part series. The first part will probably go up, by the time the show is up, it'll probably will be up. And I'll have the next two parts over the coming weeks as well. And I'm proud of it. It should be a good viewing experience for the, at least for those who are interested in the enigmatic Robert Stark and David Cole.
This ties back to the coronavirus pandemic, as I think another impact is. Unfortunately, I think it will be really bad for public spaces. People will be wanting to avoid crowded public spaces for some time being. So a lot of them could go out of business, and you could see a lot of them, some cases some of them could be, if there are malls, like the malls that have managed to survive will be completely gone. So a lot of these kind of urbanist ideals that we've discussed on past shows about like the need to invest in more communal spaces or a kind of a communal type architecture, I think the pandemic is really bad for that. A lot of arguments kind of defending like the socially atomized model of living in a track house in the suburb and driving everywhere, and it's hard to say because there are like dense urban areas that have done relatively well, and there's suburban areas that have been hit pretty bad by this. So it's too simplistic to make that the issue. Just putting aside like what areas have actually the actual impact of the coronavirus. I think just psychologically, I think it will be bad for public spaces, and it'll be interesting. For at least a while, if they manage to survive, or some of them will go out of business. But some of the places we've gone to in LA, like to see what economic impact it will have.
Yeah, it will. I mean, I'm predict. Obviously, as you said, there's no doubt that we're heading into a recession, both nationally, globally, and locally. And it's going to have a depressing effect. But then again, there's going to, you know, a bit sooner or later, this pandemic, this quarantine will end. And especially in a place like Southern California, where we all love going outside so much, it's, you know, people are going to come back in a big way. And I think it'll be competing forces. You know, there's going to be economic fallout for years, but also perhaps on the ruins of the old, new energy will sprout up. Generalities here, but you get what I'm saying. Perhaps from the decline of what previously was, that will fertilize new energy to come forth when we finally can go back out and socialize.
So it'll be a transition period. Like, it's no longer just stagnation. We are going through a transition period. So these different turning points, like 9/11 was a turning point to the first decade of the 21st century, and this is a historic turning point in going through a period of transition, and it could be like a rebirth and a renewal, or there could be like a lot of negative trends. We're heading more towards you could almost say like a dystopian future, kind of like the dystopian future that's portrayed as an alternative to the two different alternatives of the future that are portrayed in my book. Like, which one that the coronavirus pandemic will push us more in that direction?
I mean, I come back to, like, you know, are things getting better? Are things getting worse? Or are things just chugging along? You know, it's going to be hard to know. But you mean the dichotomy in your book between are we going to be forced into pod living and virtual reality simulation?
Well, actually, we can't really live in pods because pods are, unless everyone has their own airtight pod, that's not going to be viable either.
That's true. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, will we be? I mean, I think the general thing you're asking is, will we be pushed inward or outward? And chances are, it will be some combination of the two, where we are going to be spending a lot of time online. You know, we are getting sucked more and more into the simulacra of the internet, but at the same time, and not in an opposing way, we're also looking outward and trying to make sense of the world that we live in, find some kind of beauty in it, and find things to stand for, fight for, preserve where we can. The answer is somewhere in between. I mean, I think in your book, it's, you know, literature we deal in dichotomies like that, but reality is often much more blurred.
There's obviously much more nuance. Like in a book, you have one character who can be a villain. And with my writing style, I try to find some balance between the more nuanced approach, as opposed to creating an explicit character who could be a hero or a villain. I mean, I try to keep like the right balance.
Yeah, I think you do a good job of that. One thing that I want to do before we break is, you pitched your book a bit, but I would actually like, I've helped you write the book. I've done a lot of editing, and I'd like to pitch both yours and mine, if you don't mind. Robert's got this book. When do you think it'll be out? Next couple months?
I don't have an official release date, but if I had to predict, I'd predict about 3 months from now.
Yeah, likewise with my book. And Robert's got this great book coming out, but it's kind of a sequel to his debut, Journey to Vapor Island.
I don't even know if I'd call it a sequel or existing in a parallel universe.
Yeah, I guess it's more existing in a parallel universe. It's not
some of the same characters.
Same characters, same universe. But what I actually like this book more than Journey to Vapor Island because I don't know how much Robert wants me to say about it. But basically, this book focuses very much on California and living in California. It's got a lot of great locations, both in the Bay Area and in Southern California, as well as Nevada, in fact. And it just kind of focuses on what it might be like to grow up as a non-diverse individual in the middle class in California, as a kind of a shy, introverted, dare I even say sensitive type growing up with the culture here and the effects that might have on one's psyche. And it starts off with what I consider to be some of the more emotional and personal writing you've done, Robert. And slowly over time, you get to the point where things get just as outrageous as they did in your first novel, Journey to Vapor Island.
Yeah, the second part of the novel does feel more like the first.
Yeah, the second part of the novel feels more like the first, I think is the right move, but the first part of the novel is pretty arresting in terms of the way it, you know, pulls you into the world of this troubled young man.
And before I wrap things up, do you want to plug your upcoming novel?
I do, yes. So speaking of troubled young men, I also have a novel coming out. I'm currently shopping around the different publishers. I might just have to self-publish if I don't hear back in time, but it's called Dragon Day. It's a very short novel. You might even call it a novella at only 125 pages. It takes about as long to read as it would to watch a movie. But it's called Dragon Day, and the log line is that it's about a troubled young man who falls under the influence of a troubled young college student who falls under the influence of a professor with dangerous ideas. It's set in 2015, kind of in the calm before the storm of the Trump era. A lot of it's based on my own time in college, kind of seeing a lot of the SJW stuff get very popular and a lot of the protests.
Yeah, I've read it. It does have a very 2015 feel.
It's set in 2015, and I hope that doesn't make the book dated, but I think I think it's still relevant, and it took me a really long time to write it. I was working on it on and off for about, 5 or 6 years, but at this point, it's something I'm pretty proud of, and I'm looking forward to finally getting it in print and finally being, like you, Robert, a self-made author. But look for it soon. I'm shopping around the different publishers. Again, it's called Dragon Day. Whether via a publisher or self-published, it should be out sometime this year.
Yeah, we look forward to it. Matthew Pagan, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks, Robert. Yeah, it's great to be back, and I'm hoping to be doing more co-hosting in the weeks ahead. Definitely have the time for it in quarantine. Yeah, and I also deleted my old Matt P. Twitter a long time, almost a year ago, but I'm back on Twitter at Matt Pagan, just my name, plain and simple, and I'm trying to build up my following, so go ahead and give me a follow. Thanks.